18th of July, 1943. Crouched under a lone bush, you're frozen with fear. You have to make it to a Swedish ship loading coal in the dock. To the south, you know there are sentries on the lookout for an escaped prisoner of war. Their bright arc lights are pointed in your direction, almost reaching, but not quite. Between you and freedom, there are more obstacles. Unpassable marshland, fences, train tracks. What is guiding you as you carefully navigate your way? A map, smuggled in, light as a feather, and it might just save your life. I'm Jerry Broughton, a map historian. Welcome to What's Your Map? An Oculi Mundi Exploration. In this series, we hear from those who live, love, and work with maps, making, preserving, interpreting, and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that is special to them and to tell us the story that lies behind it. To follow the map as we talk about it on this podcast, go to oculi-mundi.com. We've all heard of MI5, MI6, and even GCHQ. But have you ever come across MI9? Barbara Bond worked as a cartographic researcher for the Ministry of Defence for more than four decades, and it was while she was working in the department's archives that she discovered the thousands of secret escape maps produced by MI9 during the Second World War. Created in 1939, this secret branch of the intelligence services operated during the war with the sole purpose of helping Allied soldiers evade and escape capture. The top secret nature of MI9 meant that its existence wasn't made publicly known until the 1970s, around the time Barbara stumbled across the organization's most remarkable achievement. Her career would eventually see her become director of the UK Hydrographic Office, the government body in charge of improving our navigation of the sea. After retiring, Barbara began her PhD research into the extraordinary map she'd discovered all those years ago, which was published as the book Great Escapes in 2015. Barbara, welcome to What's Your Map? You have something to show us, I believe.
Thank you, Jerry, for your welcome. Yes, you asked me to show you my favourite map, and that is what we're looking at the moment. We are looking at a section of a British Admiralty chart. It essentially is the mouth of the River Vistula.
And this is a map that shows the port of Danzig. Can you just explain the importance of Danzig and why we're looking at this map of Danzig?
Because MI9 decided that one of the best escape routes, and certainly in the end they were proved correct because almost 30% of escaping prisoners of war made their escape through a Baltic port on a Swedish ship. Because if you could get onto a Swedish ship, you were essentially home and dry because Sweden was a neutral country in World War II. And once you were in Sweden, they would simply hand you over to the British authorities.
And what's significant about Danzig as a port?
Well, there were four major Baltic ports that MI9 honed in on, and Danzig was the principal one because Swedish ships were known to berth there regularly. The others were, I think, Lübeck, Stettin, and Gdynia.
And it's now Gdansk, as we know it, so it has a kind of long, complex history as a port as well. Take me through this map, as it were, orientate me.
It doesn't show any locational information other than north being skewed. It's not orientated in quite the normal way, the standard way, I should say.
So if we look at this map in the northeast quadrant, we can see that there is a compass point, but we can see north is pointing very obliquely or off to the side there, that we have the River Vistula running through from sort of northwest down into the southeast. And what else are we seeing? Because we can see cranes, we can see sentry points, we can see open land. Just take me through what kind of terrain we're seeing here.
I think the best way to describe it is that although it's a British Admiralty chart, it has been stripped of all marine navigational information because that's not its purpose. And the points that you have picked up and described are basically intelligence provided by successful escapers who have made it back to London eventually and are feeding back their own experience of escaping through this route. If you look at the wharf area in the southwest quadrant, you see annotations such as Swedish ships load coal here, Swedish ships unload ore here. And the objective was to get on board a Swedish ship because it was a neutral country and you were essentially free.
And to the southwest, just take me through what we see here and what's being described.
It describes the nature of the terrain, impassable marsh. In other words, don't try and get across there. Open farmland intersected by ditches. So hide in the ditch to avoid detection because you had to essentially get across the railway line to get to the wharf, hopefully to be able to board a Swedish ship without being recognised or picked up.
And you see these points of sentries dotted across the southern quadrant of the map too.
It's all intelligence, what to see, identify and avoid, trying to feed back information that MI9 had gained from successful escapers. It's all really valuable intelligence so that the chap who's trying to make the Swedish ship will hopefully get there.
So in effect, there's nothing on this map that isn't related to the intelligence that's required for escape. Every element, really. So in the north side of the river, you've got oil tanks, you've even got the tramway, you've got the tram depot. So it's all about movement, transportation, how to get from one place to the other, what to avoid.
The whole focus of this map is this is the area you're making for. Don't let yourself be caught by any of these other things.
In the southwest of the map. Yeah. And that's interesting, isn't it? So you can't actually, I'm just thinking about it, that you can't even show, as it were, a route because a route would be compromised. So there's also this sense in which you're given this information, but then you have to make your own decisions about how you move to evade capture and with the aim of, hopefully, would it be to get on one of those Swedish ships and then to get up the Vistula River and out. And once you're out, effectively, you've escaped.
Once you were on board the ship, you had effectively escaped. And the bulletin, the MI9 handbook, actually would give you information about how to handle yourself when you're on board, what to say to the people on board, what point do you declare, I'm an escaping POW to the Swedish. My understanding is that most of these escapes, they were so successful because they came via Swedish ships and Sweden was a neutral country and a very honourable neutral country. They absolutely abided by the rules of neutrality. Mm-hmm. And they would not have handed this man back because he was on board one of their ships.
How big would the original map have been, Barbara? If you were carrying the map, how big would it be?
It varied. These were relatively small. And some of them were called handkerchief maps because they were so small. But many of them are quite large in their physical extent because they're small scale and covering large areas. I mean, for example, IMW, International Map of the World size, but because they're on silk or rayon, they will fold down and you can stuff them away.
So you can literally ram them in your pocket and pull them out.
A lot of them were actually stitched inside uniforms,
in
between the lining and the outer jacket.
Extraordinary. So how is it being used? I mean, if I were an escaped Allied soldier, how would I be bringing this to aid my escape?
So basically what was happening is they were using it as an exit point. Successful escapers would be interviewed by MI9 on their return to London. And they would provide as much intelligence information as they could, having escaped through that route. and MI9 fed that back into the escape map.
So this is a map also which is layered because it will have been drawn on previous escapees feeding that information back into MI9, and then these maps are being updated and then being used to enable successful escapes. What else can you see here that you found significant that's important for the escapees?
I think the most significant point is the location of the lighting in the port and the extent of the beam of light being shown. And that is marked in what essentially is the southwest corner.
And Barbara, why is there a large lone bush at the bottom there?
I was wondering if you'd spot that. Yes, your idea is as good as mine as to what it was useful.
We don't know. Oh, that's great. What, is it to hide in?
I suspect that it was a point in the open area where there was some cover.
That's brilliant. Where are the prisoners of war being kept in relation to this map? Where does Danzig figure in that wider world of the prisoner of war camps?
They could be coming from anywhere. There were principal escape points were via Baltic ports, or if the camp was located geographically closer to Switzerland, then they had a corridor of escape that they had identified and equally mapped through across the Swiss border. This was the most successful route, and I suspect it was because, not easier, that's the wrong word to use, but once you'd gone on board the ship, you were free.
So would there be a whole series of maps that the POWs would be using until they got to this point?
Yeah.
So this is really a kind of very powerful map in the sense that you're nearly out.
This is the target. This is where you're aiming to get to. MI9 had a massive mapping program. I mean, in the end, they had produced over 2 million copies of escape and evasion maps. So they had total coverage at some stage of Western Europe in particular. What they were essentially doing was trying to provide maps into the camp. Now, if they got a map in, they had to copy it. So there were lots of people making copies of maps in the camps, either for themselves to escape or as an aid for somebody else to escape. And I actually at one stage did find two maps, which were simply copies. They're very faded copies by that time.
Before they're being copied, how are they getting into the camps?
Mm-hmm.
Because this is presumably an act of espionage in itself to smuggle the maps in. And presumably the Germans were aware to some extent that this was potentially a way of getting this cartographic material in. What are the stories behind that process, Barbara?
How long have you got, Joe?
Well, I suspect the stories are very, very interesting and elaborate.
Basically, by, and you've already mentioned it, that age-old British pastime of smuggling. So they were being sent out there in records, in books, in chess sets, in cricket bats.
In
gramophone records, yes.
So they'd be pressed inside the record?
Yes. The record had to be smashed on receipt in order to get the map. And that particular operation was described or named by MI9 as Operation Smash Hits.
It's too good. It's too good.
Black British humour.
That's fantastic. Do we know what the records were?
We know what they weren't. They specifically were not German.
Right, okay.
Anything that the Germans would balk at, they were very carefully selected.
Right. This is amazing. How big were they and what were they made of? Because presumably this is also another issue. You can't have a big fold-out map. They're presumably small. What are they? And what are they made of?
The ones that were laminated inside the record were either paper or silk. The ones that were in the escape kits were usually silk or rayon later on because we ran out of silk. Because silk was used for parachute production and that was a priority. And most of our silk was sourced in areas that were occupied either by the Germans or the Japanese. So we ran out of silk very early on. But the Americans came into the war, they brought their technology with them and rayon was the standard way.
And is there any account of the Germans intercepting these maps or a way in which they're disrupting this process and that they understand what's happening?
the Germans were actually quite helpful initially because a lot of the parcels that went in, they didn't go in as Red Cross parcels. They went in as parcels from some sort of charitable organisation, which MI9 had set up. They were entirely fictitious, but they were wonderfully titled, these companies. The Ladies Knitting Circle was one of them, and the Licensed Victuallers Sports Association. So the parcels were going in. The Germans actually, on occasion, were allowing the recipients to send, there was a little receipt note inside, and the Germans were allowing them to acknowledge receipt and post them back. So MI9 knew when a lot of the parcels got through. If the parcel was discovered, they would usually get the intelligence back through the coded system, and MI9 would never send another parcel containing that item to that camp, to that individual ever again. So yes, there was an awareness. If you read the MI9 diaries, there's an awareness of the volume that was getting through. And the Germans did know at one point, because they were using, would you believe, they were X-raying the parcels at one point.
The stories are lovely, Barbara, and we are fascinated by it. And it's all a bit James Bond and a bit Cloak and Dagger. However, we have to think these maps were being taken by extremely brave men who, it was a real life and death thing. So we can look at this map, but also think they're moving across enemy territory at any point using this map, thinking they may be captured and they may be killed. I mean, there's a real poignancy, I guess, to looking at these maps in terms of they were life and death.
That was brought home to me very much so when I had the privilege of interviewing Michael Foote. Michael Foote was one of the co-authors of the first authorised history of MI9. And I should hasten to add, not the Michael Foote, who was a very well-known politician. Interestingly, Michael himself was an escaper, but he was a captured escaper. So he never actually got out until he was liberated. But one of the things that Michael brought with him was his own personal escape map, very bedraggled. Rayon, his was produced on Rayon map, and showed it to me. And one of the things that always concerned me was the small scale of some of these maps. You know, how on earth could you hope to navigate your way in occupied France through to the Spanish border? How on earth were you going to do that on the basis of a one in a million? You know, I mean, it was unbelievable for me. And when I said this to him, he looked me straight in the eye and he said, "Barbara, my dear, when your life depends on it, you can navigate on anything."
Wow.
And that's what they were. You know, they were the key to their survival, the key to their escape.
The numbers are extraordinary, though, aren't they, that these maps are helping how many POWs escape in this period?
The total escape was of the order of 36,000. You cannot credit MI9 with helping all of them. But what you can say is that MI9 was the organisation which was responsible for all the education, all the training, all the gadgetry that went to support the system of getting the maps into the camps.
So tell me exactly how MI9 emerged. Were they an offshoot from the other intelligence services? Who was driving it, Barbara?
I think it was a culmination of many things. There were a number of people in influential posts at the outbreak of war, both in the military and in the political world. For example, Churchill himself was an escaper, a successful escaper in the Boer War. And in fact, it was Churchill who essentially was the trigger for the setting it up. There was a big fight going on as well as to who was going to control it, because SIS, Special Intelligence Service, very much wanted to control it. And it was Churchill who decided that they wouldn't. It would go in the War Office because it was servicing all three services, essentially. Churchill himself personally wrote the foreword to the MI9 bulletin, which is basically the MI9 handbook. I've always described it as the do-it-yourself for escape and evasion. It has everything in it that you could possibly imagine. You know, how to dress, how to walk, because if you're a soldier, you march, don't you? And that's a giveaway if you're trying to escape. So how to walk like a peasant, It's all in the book.
The story of these incredible maps and MI9 is amazing. I can only imagine what it was like to receive one, copy one, or try to use one. But before we hear more from Barbara, I'd love for you to join our global community of explorers by subscribing to this podcast. From mapping sounds to charting constellations, we have a wealth of episodes for you to enjoy. And subscribing means you won't miss a single new map, guest, or story from this series, or the next. Now, back to Barbara Bond, to hear how she became a pioneer in cartographic research. Okay, now let's talk about your life and how, actually, you ended up really working on these amazing maps. Let's go right back to your childhood. Do you remember when you first became interested in maps and globes?
Vividly. I think I was about 8 or 9 at the time, and I couldn't understand why it was one time one place in the world and another time another place in the world. And my father bought me a globe. It had a disc over the North Pole where you could move the disc round, set the time to one place in the world and read the time off another place in the world. I'm not sure, looking back, that I ever at that stage grasped the concept of time, but what I did grasp was this amazing world with all these mountains and rivers and streams and oceans. And I was just fascinated by the globe. And my interest in mapping was triggered at that point. When I got to choosing a university degree, I very much wanted to do cartography, one of the oldest of the earth sciences. And there wasn't a British university that offered a degree in cartography.
Which is staggering.
It is.
It is very surprising.
We're talking about the 1960s. I know I'm old, but...
I mean, people who are listening to the podcast, I'm sure, will be interested in maps, but also interested to know it's not something that you necessarily can study as a subject. And you were interesting because you were telling me, so you were really moving between geography and history in an attempt to really work on mapping.
Exactly so. And I discovered that you couldn't read cartography, I decided, well, okay, geography, and then realized that if I could some way combine it with history, because maps are very much a statement of historical aspect as well as anything else, then perhaps that was a good combination that would lead to somewhere that I wanted to work on or work with.
And was military mapping always part of that, or did that come later? That's a later process.
That's a later process. I was at Leeds, and when I got into my final year, they had this little office that you could go to for help in getting a job or whatever.
Career service.
One of the early ones, I suspect. Yeah. I just said, well, I would like to do something with maps. I very clearly remember it. They came up with two possibilities. Mm. One was the Directorate of Overseas Survey, sadly no longer in existence, and the other was the Directorate of Military Survey. And I chose the military survey one simply because I thought, well, that's going to be a wider geographical spread.
And so then what did that lead to in terms of the work that you were doing and using maps?
I had the good fortune to start off in the research area in military survey, which was in those days was called the Map Research and Library Group. I was in the mapping analysis section where your job was essentially the compilation of a military map. So you had a specification to work with, whatever military map you were producing, and you did the analysis to support that work.
And did you love it? And I'm also curious, but both in terms of the,
you loved it. Absolutely.
And were there any issues around being a woman? Because we know, notoriously, geography and mapping is a very male domain. Were the problems that you encountered there as a woman?
Yes and no. Essentially, you're on the graduate staff, so there were women as well as men. I'd like to refer to them as challenges. They developed more widely. There was discrimination. There was, because you were doing a job that people didn't anticipate you would be doing. There was one classic phone call of somebody saying to me, oh, I wasn't expecting... I'm looking for somebody by name. I said, well, I'm doing his job now. Can I help you? Mm. It was an interesting exchange. He actually, in the end, he said, I'll ring you back and put the phone down. And then he rang me back 10 minutes later and apologized, which was fine. But yes, there were difficulties. I always tried, and I I've always said this to people. There's no point in getting upset by it. I used to laugh. And I found humour was actually the best thing to do because you cause people embarrassment by laughing. And they hesitate to do it again. It was always the same in meetings, you know. You would go to a meeting and it would be, good afternoon, gentlemen. Yeah. But you have to laugh. That was my way of dealing with it.
And it's also a period that geopolitically things changed a lot in that later 20th century moment. What did you see? What were you watching, especially in terms of how maps were being used? Because you were right at the heart of that in terms of civil defence. What was happening?
In a way, looking back, I was living the revolution, but I didn't recognise it at the time.
What was the revolution you were living?
Computers. Yeah. We were producing very early, we call them moving maps, but they were basically the first step in producing something you could look at on a screen. Looking back, it became more interesting. I mean, it was interesting enough at the time, but looking back, you realise that those were the early days of this amazing revolution that has happened, producing spatial databases to underpin map use. And the technology really has left me behind because I find it mind-blowing now to be aware of exactly what can be done in map production and spatial databases, driving your car.
But within the midst of that revolution that you were seeing even in your work, you then shift again because you, as it were, go into the academic world because you wrote a PhD and you worked on these amazing MI9 escape maps. How did that happen? What was going on there? Because that's a bit of a move, bit of a shift.
Again, that was happen chance. After I retired, I suddenly, out of the blue, got a letter from the University of Plymouth. We'd be very interested in talking to you with a view to joining our board. So I went down to Plymouth and had a very pleasant encounter with these two gentlemen, at the end of which I remember saying to them, you know, why me? Mm. And the chat said, well, not only did you fit the profile of what we were looking for, but very importantly for us, you were a woman. They didn't have a single woman on the board. And so I joined that and loved it. I mean, it was going back into academia and it was a wonderful experience. And I became chair of the board after a few years. And I remember having very interesting conversation with the then vice chancellor. We had a different vice chancellor by that time. I said, oh, yeah, I've always wanted to do my PhD. And she just looked at me and said, well, do it.
Yeah.
So it's happened chance.
And then working with this archive of material, because it is very different. I mean, it's an extraordinary collection of maps and the stories are wonderful. When was your first experience of this? Tell me how you encountered it. Was there a sense of shock and amazement at this work? Did you sort of back your way into it? What was the process?
The process, again, was almost happen chance. I was moved from doing mapping analysis work into the map library. And I resisted it. You know, I'm not a librarian. I don't want to sit and catalogue and organise maps. I want to work with them. My director was saying, no, Barbara, you have to get experience across the piece, you know, if you're going to develop your career. So I was moved into the map library. And this is one of the biggest map libraries. It's a huge map collection. So the actual physical library is rows and rows of very high standing map presses. And on the top of these map presses were lots of cardboard boxes with excess maps or maps that hadn't been catalogued. And I just was going through one of them one day, opened a box that was full of maps on material. And I'd never seen a map on material before. I didn't even know what the material was.
Were they even catalogued as MI9?
No. They had no identifier. I had no idea what it was. And so I asked my then principal, and, you know, what's this stuff? And he said, that's some World War II escape invasion stuff. You know, it needs to be catalogued and sorted because, you know, we haven't got a record set and blah, blah, blah. So I said, oh, you're right. Okay. I'll have a look at that. And that was where it started.
But even then, did you go, World War II escape maps?
I mean, presumably,
the fact somebody says that casually, you do want to stop and go, that's extraordinary.
He didn't mention MI9.
Ah, that's interesting. So it was the maps that led you to MI9. So then you're looking at the maps, and then what? There's a sort of cascade of material that you start to unravel, that you start to come across, and then the story of MI9 follows.
Very much so. And one of the triggers was that there used to be a radio program. It was called Down Your Way. They had gone to, I can't even remember the town, but I know it was a town in Kent. And one of the people they were talking to was the librarian of the Intelligence Corps Museum, which happened to be located in this particular town they were visiting. And listening to this, I'm thinking, Intelligence Corps? Maps? So I followed up and asked permission if I could go down and visit. And yes, I could. And they had this collection of maps.
I do want to ask you, is there anything within the jigsaw puzzle of the maps that you put together? Is there anything that you couldn't fit, that was missing, because you're dealing with such classified material, the secrecy of these maps? Is there anything that you just knew that you couldn't get, you couldn't reach, or the questions that couldn't be asked in doing this work?
I think the biggest one at the time was MI9's coded letter system. I was aware that there was this coded correspondence going on between the camps and MI9. And they'd set up this entire system. And I was privileged to be offered access to the estate of Johnny Pryor, who had been captured. He was captured at D-Day and had spent some long time working with this coded correspondence system. And some of his letters, I think about a dozen letters, were still held by his son. And his son, again, happened chance, his son happened to be a colleague on the board at Plymouth. And he said, I've got some letters that my dad wrote, you know, and sent home. And he said, I'm told that they're coded, and would you like to look at them? Oh, yes, please. I was fortunate enough to have part of the code. The code was always two numbers followed by an alphabet letter. And I had the two numbers, but I didn't have the alphabet letter. A particular mathematician at Plymouth, he said, I'll have a look at that. And he was the guy who cracked it. And what he did was he started off trying every alphabet letter in turn. And when he found it, he rang me up and he said, I think I've got it. Pop in next time you're down. So I went into his office a couple of days later and he sat me down and he explained to me what the code was and how it worked. He said, right, now you do it. And he made me do it for myself, which was brilliant, because suddenly this coded message came out from the letter.
Wonderful.
And would you believe that one of the things that was being asked for was maps?
Of course it was. And you cracked the code. You cracked the code.
No, he cracked the code.
Well, yeah, but you
but I was able to read the coded message.
And there was a map. There was a map. Yeah. Barbara Bond, it's just been absolutely a real privilege to talk to you about this. The stories that you've told are amazing. Thank you so much for joining me on What's Your Map? It's been wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. It's been a pleasure.
To hear some of the ways that MI9 smuggled escape maps into POW camps and the human journeys that were made using them are hugely inspiring for me. I think it shows an incredible capacity for innovation and ingenuity during truly desperate times. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jerry Broughton. This has been an Oculi Mundi exploration. The producer is Emily Uchida Finch at Whistledown Studios. Oculi Mundi is the online home of the Sunderland collection of antique maps and atlases. You can read more about the Sunderland collection and send suggestions for future maps to explore at oculi-mundi.com.